Welcome to the Hero Maker Podcast. I'm Andrea Schreeman, writer, director, EP, living in LA.
I'm Jennifer Morrison, and I currently serve as the Commissioner of Public Safety for the state of Vermont.
We are here to seek out and tell the full story of our friends who were murdered in college, Rachel Raver and Warren Fulton III.
We really need to make sure that their deaths were not in vain and that every possible lesson and improvement for the system can be squeezed from the retelling of the circumstances that ultimately led to the identification of their killer. Today, I am pleased to bring to you Rebecca Wilkins, who is an employee of the Vermont Forensic Lab, which is within the Division of Public Safety. And she is our CODIS administrator, so she is our resident DNA expert.
Yeah, and it's great to talk about the science because it is definitely what solved Rachel and Warren's case, especially after all those years. And Rebecca has been in the game for a while, almost two decades. And so she's seen a lot of changes and she has a great perspective. And this particular episode is another advertisement for the state of Vermont.
Thank you.
There was a lot of really rich, beautiful information about why the Vermont Forensic Lab is so effective and its level of commitment to being on the cutting edge. And also, Vermont's a unique state in that it has a fairly small population. I think you said like 600,000. When you're working with a smaller population, I think you definitely have some advantages in terms of crime solving and safety and all that stuff. But why not look at a smaller population, see how things are working well, and then try to replicate that in larger spaces? I think that's important.
Yeah, we're like a walking beta test for a lot of things in Vermont because you can get your arms around a statewide initiative or pilot project. I'm very excited to talk to Rebecca, and I'm a huge fan of the work they do. So take it away, Rebecca.
Jen, why don't you start by introducing me to Rebecca and telling us, meaning me and the audience, how you know Rebecca and why you thought she would be a good guest for the show.
Rebecca is one of the amazing members of our Vermont Forensic Laboratory that is in a little bit of a castle all to themselves on the end of the DPS headquarters building. So I don't get to actually see them very much, but I am keenly aware of the outstanding work they do. And Rebecca is our, I believe her title is CODIS administrator. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
All right. And I knew she would be a great fit because so much of our story of Rachel and Warren and all the other people that this case touches were connected by DNA. And so she's our resident expert, and I knew she would be somebody that could contribute to our understanding of how these cases came together, but also for our audience to learn from as well. So welcome, Rebecca. Thanks for taking the time on a Saturday morning.
Absolutely. I'm glad to be here. I'm Rebecca Wilkins. I run the CODIS system for the state of Vermont. I have been working for the lab since 2005, so that's 17 years now. I am both responsible for processing samples from convicted offenders and also all of the software maintenance, and also for sending the match reports out when the software generates them. So my job takes a couple different approaches, but the overarching theme is the CODIS system. CODIS is basically just a piece of software that the FBI has programmed and shared with all of the states that stores DNA profiles and then searches them against each other.
What does CODIS stand for?
CODIS stands for Combined DNA Index System.
Can you tell us just a little more about like what that looks like from the crime scene to you and then beyond, like the life cycle of a DNA sample?
Absolutely. A police officer or investigator will collect something from a crime scene that will have DNA from the perpetrator on it. Frequently it's a cigarette butt, and sends it into the lab. And then my coworkers who do the casework analysis will extract DNA from that. Your mouth sheds a lot of DNA cells. So cigarette butts, again, are a great source of DNA. And we profile that. We look at STRs, which are short tandem repeat. It's a region of DNA that doesn't code for anything specific, but is highly variable. So each person has their own unique DNA profile. And then when we get that, we upload it into the CODIS software. On the flip side, we collect DNA samples from anyone who's convicted of a qualifying crime. And each state has their own laws regarding what that qualifying crime is. And we upload those STR profiles into CODIS also. And the software compares them, comes up with matches, and I print those out. We review them. If everything looks like a valid match, then we send a report to the investigator that says, this profile matches to an offender sample with this name. Here's their identifying information. Go collect a standard. And then they go back, they get a standard, and we do the comparison again, actually, to directly between the suspect and the evidence. And then that's what goes to court.
So the actual match, so to speak, generated out of CODIS is not enough to take to a courtroom. You have to go get a sample from the person who is implicated by CODIS and then do further analysis.
That's correct. Yeah. And that is specifically because the profiles from convicted offenders in the software are not evidentiary. They're collected post-conviction, and people who have qualifying crimes have a diminished expectation of privacy. So that's why we're allowed to keep their DNA in the database. And then because it's non-evidentiary, it can't be presented in court. So we need a direct comparison between a standard from the suspect that is a piece of evidence and the crime scene.
So you mentioned cigarette butts as being a common type of evidence that might come in from the field. Can you tell us some more about what types of material you draw DNA from? And
yeah, what's the weirdest? I want to know the weirdest thing.
I know,
thing
I forgot that down, most unusual.
Let's see. The most unusual ones. There's a couple real fun stories. We have gotten DNA profiles off of yellow snow.
Very Vermont-y.
Gotten DNA profiles off of baked goods. You know, like the robber is in the house and they get a little hungry. So they grab a granola bar or a piece of pizza out of the fridge or something, and they're eating it while they're burglarizing the place, and they leave the crust behind, and we can get DNA off that. There's some entertaining ones.
What do you normally see? Like, is it the coffee cup?
It's a lot of cigarette butts. If it's an auto theft, there's frequently a bottle of, you know, Gatorade, soda, beer, because people who are stealing cars don't care about those rules. A lot of bottles and cans. I mean, we get a lot of sexual assault kits because that is a common source of DNA for the CODIS database. So those are our common ones.
Do you have any stories about your favorite matches? Like, were there any cases that really either you're super extra proud of or they were just big and stick with you in your memory?
Actually, there was a recent one that sticks with me that I can talk about, which was the vandalism of the Black Lives Matter road painting in Montpelier. And they had collected rags and the bottles of spray paint and everything because the guy had vandalized the painting and then just dumped it all in the next dumpster over. And we got a DNA match off of it. And it turned out that the perpetrator had died in a car crash after vandalizing the mural and before the CODIS match came through. That one was interesting because we didn't get a standard to compare to the crime. We sent the report out and they went, oh, this guy's dead now. But so then it went into the news. And that was interesting to me because CODIS doesn't actually hit the news very often because we don't go to court. A lot of crimes are solved by CODIS, but the software itself doesn't ever get mentioned. And in this case, the news reports were all like, CODIS solved this crime because we didn't have a follow-up standard for it.
Oh, that's interesting. Right. So it's sort of like the guy in the back room looking through all the records, doing all the clerical work, but the one out front who goes and gets the match is the one who gets all the attention, right?
Yes. Everyone knows CSI, the TV show. And people say, well, which character are you? And I say, I'm the one in the background that never talks.
You brought up court. Mm-hmm. And that was going to be one of my questions is, are you ever asked to testify? But it seems like maybe you're not based on what you just said. Have you ever been asked or have you testified for anything?
I have testified a couple of times in post-conviction cases, and those are much less interesting because it's generally an offender who's been convicted of a qualifying crime, but doesn't want to give a sample or claims that he's already given a sample or that the evidence that was collected from the crime scene should count as a sample, and so he shouldn't have to give another one. And so then I get called into court to testify about why we need yet another sample from the individual. So those are not very interesting, but that's what I end up testifying about. My coworkers who process the crime scene evidence do testify in court on a semi-regular basis.
Can you share anecdotally something about why it's important and the difference that you can make when your colleagues do testify in court?
Yeah.
Like, why is it necessary? We have all the evidence, right? We have the science and we have the reports, but like, what difference does it make when you all show up and talk about the reports?
Part of it is because in American law, I call them the perpetrator, but the defendant is entitled to face their accuser in court. And so at the base level, the analyst who does the DNA processing is the accuser in that case, saying your DNA was found at this crime scene. But also having a DNA analyst come to court and testify can help explain what the DNA match means, how significant it is, how likely it would be to happen fortuitously and not actually be that suspect. We did a lot of testifying when DNA was first being used because, I mean, I think everyone knows about the O.J. Simpson case, how there was DNA and yet he got off because the jury didn't fully understand what a DNA match looked like. And then there was the golden age of DNA where everyone was like, yeah, this is perfect and we know exactly what it means and it's clearly them. And now we're getting more into profiles off of crime scenes that are mixed. So you've got more than one person's DNA in the crime scene sample, and then you need to bring the analyst in to explain how you figure out who's a part of that and how you do that comparison.
Is that just because DNA detection has gotten so much better that we're picking up layers beyond the top layer or something?
That's exactly right. In the late 90s, we were just testing blood, biological fluids. There was a lot of DNA and it was all from one person. And now we're testing swabs off of countertops at the convenience store and how many people have touched that, or a doorknob or a steering wheel from a car that was stolen. If it's the steering wheel of a stolen car, we'll have the profile of the person who owns the car, as well as the profile of the person who stole the car. And we have to be able to differentiate between those two. So it's a lot more complicated.
That's interesting. And then is there a way, like, are they timestamped?
No, the DNA is not timestamped. That is definitely something that DNA analysis is coming up against now, is what we refer to as the activity level of the DNA. Like, why is it there? We can't say as the DNA experts. We can say, this is the DNA profile, or this is the mixture. These are the people who've contributed. But then it's up to the investigators to say how that DNA got there, who's responsible for it, to determine whether or not it was consensual, all of those things.
So you're a piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. But we're not the whole puzzle.
So what attracted you to this area of science? Were you a total nerd your whole life?
I have been a total nerd my whole life. That's exactly right. I am actually probably one of the last people hired at the lab who didn't get into forensics on purpose. I was a biology major. I was doing DNA extraction on soil samples, actually, in college. And then I wanted a job that would let me stay in Vermont. And the forensic lab was hiring for DNA processing. So that's how I got the job. A lot of people who go into the field now are going into it because they want to be in forensics. They saw the TV shows, they were impacted by some kind of crime being solved earlier in life, and they're like, I want to do that. Whereas I sort of fell into it by accident. But it is a great job because I know that I'm making a huge difference every single day.
Are you a native Vermonter?
I actually grew up in New Hampshire.
Whereabouts?
Down in Amherst, which is just between Massachusetts and Nashua, that area.
Yeah, I grew up in Hanover. Oh, familiar perfect. With that whole area.
Yep.
If you don't mind, just tell us a little bit more about you. How did you decide you wanted to stay in Vermont?
I grew up in sort of suburban New Hampshire. I actually did my freshman year at Boston University, and I wanted to test out living in the big city. And I discovered I hated living in the big city. It was much too impersonal. So I transferred to the University of Vermont for my sophomore year because I was like, okay, this is just the right amount of city. Like, I can walk to the lake. I can also walk to the nearest dairy farm. Perfect. And I just fell in love with living in Vermont. So then when I was graduating, I knew I wanted to stay in Vermont. And I had a biology degree, I had a chemistry minor. I was like, okay, so I'm interested in science. I just started looking at all of the science labs and trying to figure out which one could hire me.
And here we are 17 years later, right?
Yeah, I'm very happy with where I landed.
So let's talk about those 17 years. I mean, you've already described some of the changes in the work that you do. What have been some of the really broad stroke improvements, changes in DNA collection and detection, and anything you can speak to on that?
Yeah, absolutely. The Vermont samples were actually blood samples up until mid-2004, which is just before I started, but we still have the old blood samples as well. And going from a blood draw to a buccal swab, which is just a swab of the inside of the cheek, was major enhancement because it is less intrusive. And when we only did blood samples, it was just violent felonies that we were collecting for. And then when we went to cheek swabs, it was less intrusive. And so then the legislators were able to pass a law that said, okay, now we're going to collect from all felons. And that has increased the size of the offender pool that we're comparing against, which lets us solve more crime. And then we've also changed how many of the STR loci, the loci are the individual regions of DNA we're looking at. And when I started, we were just looking at 13, and now we're looking at 22. So we've increased the sensitivity by looking at more regions of DNA. So that's another major change. I don't know how into the weeds you want to get. The state of Vermont actually went to an all-array DNA collection in 2011, which meant that we weren't just collecting DNA from people who were convicted, but also people who'd been arrested and arraigned. And that's a national trend to go to either arraignee or arrestee collection. But in the state of Vermont, we have increased expectations of privacy in our state constitution. And even though the U.S. Supreme Court has determined that arrestee collection is legal under the U.S. Constitution, the Vermont State Supreme Court determined that arraignee DNA collection was not legal under the Vermont Constitution. So that law actually got overturned, and instead the legislators went to looking at collecting DNA from what I call more violent or more personal misdemeanors. So that would be the most recent update to our law. And that allows us to collect DNA from crimes like stalking and domestic assault and violation of an abuse prevention order. So there's a couple of crimes. I saw you make that face. A lot of people don't realize that those crimes can be misdemeanors, but they can. And so collecting DNA from those crimes helps us to solve when a perpetrator sort of escalates and they move from just a misdemeanor stalking to a more violent crime, we already have their DNA profile and we can match it.
Yeah, that seems like a much better pool, actually.
Yeah.
It just seems like you can arrest people and they get arraigned because it was a mistaken arrest or, you know,
yep.
I know that everybody's doing the best job they can possibly do, but it seems like someone who's got a prior conviction for these violent, that's a great way to go. Way to go, Vermont.
Yeah, I agree. And especially because there are felonies which are nonviolent. Like you can have an unlawful trespass felony. And I would, on a personal level, I feel like collecting from the convicted domestic assault perpetrators is more useful than collecting from an arraigned unlawful trespass. I feel like the Vermont law has evolved in a really useful way.
So you came on the job in 2004, and that's not long after our case generated the first CODIS match. I don't know. Do you know anything about Rachel and Warren's case?
I've listened to the first couple of episodes of your podcast. Yeah.
Aww, okay. Yay. We have a listener.
Thanks. Watch out. We'll be shaking you down for a donation if you say that again. Obviously, you know, in our case, we had a situation where our friends were murdered. Our girlfriend, Rachel, was raped. It was a formative and terrible time in our college lives.
Yeah.
And then nothing resolved. It just was out there for so long. And then we all left college. We go off, we begin our careers. You know that this happened. It's still in your consciousness. You talk about it certainly as the anniversaries rolled around, but nothing happens. And then all of a sudden, seemingly out of the blue,
mm-hmm.
there's this connection between Rachel and Warren's case and another case in the greater Washington metro area.
Yeah.
I wonder if you have any cases like that where something from way back, all of a sudden, a match comes up.
We actually have a really fabulous, it's not a fabulous story. It's a horrible story, but it has a really wonderful result. And that is the Patricia Scoville case.
Yeah.
Yes. And she had moved from Washington, D.C. to Vermont because she wanted to get out of the city and be in a safer place. And she was out for a hike in Stowe when she was raped and murdered. And her body was found in a shallow grave. And this was in the 90s. And her parents live over in upstate New York, but they were a huge part of why Vermont has a DNA database.
That's right.
And her parents lobbied for DNA databases in Vermont and across the country, honestly, because they knew that that was the only way their daughter's crime was going to be solved. And it was actually 2004, just before I started at the lab, that we got a match between her case and a convicted offender in Vermont. And so CODIS actually did solve her case after her parents put all of that effort into getting the database up and running and all of the lobbying and all of the work they did.
I remember that case. I do.
In that particular case, do either one of you know, was the offender retried for her case, or?
Yeah, he was tried and convicted.
That's correct. I remember the case. I remember her parents being very public with their advocacy.
Yep.
A little bit like Didi, except maybe even because, you know, small state, you get access to lawmakers real easily. They were very engaged with Vermont legislature.
Yes.
And that is exactly right, what Rebecca just said about our initial DNA collection laws being very much attributable to Patricia Scoville's parents and their efforts. So when we talk about the hidden heroes in life and in these cases, her parents turned their grief into this tremendously powerful advocacy. And we know that that has made more than just that connection for their daughter.
Absolutely.
What do you think people get wrong about your work? And how would you like to set the record straight?
Oh, I'm laughing because there's so many. I feel like the overarching understanding people have is not that far off. Everything is much slower than what people expect. And I know that when you are the victim of a crime, that can be exceptionally frustrating. The legal system moves slowly and the science has to follow the legal system. So we can't move too quickly. I do laugh because we don't, you know, type in the profile and then instantly have a picture pop up with the offender and his home address. That's not how that works at all. The system is just DNA profiles. It doesn't have any names or anything in it. So when I get a match out of the CODIS software, I have to go and like pull the file card out of a filing cabinet to find the offender's name. And then I have to go to a different system to run a background check and make sure that they're actually qualified. And then we actually reprocess all of the DNA on the convicted offenders before we send a match out. Again, because it's non-evidentiary, so we're rechecking the lab work before we send out the report, just to dot our I's and cross our T's and make sure everything was done correctly. And then we send the report. And then the investigator has to go and get another sample, and it gets processed. There's a lot of steps. And of course, the TV shows make it all look very seamless because that moves the plot along faster, but it's not how the real world works.
No, it's not, because by the time the match is received by the investigator, that begins an entire another process for the investigator. You have to locate the offender. You have to go back and check your story and your investigative timeline, all the details. You have to ask the court for, in many cases, now I guess it's just an NTO because it's so much less invasive. It used to be a search warrant for blood.
Yep.
Now it's just a non-testimonial order for the buccal swab. And then you have to find the person, serve it, collect it.
Yep.
Package it properly, get it properly back to the lab, and then you guys start again with that sample. So there are a lot of steps, and it has to all be done very precisely in order to maintain the chain of custody and keep the sample viable, etc.
Exactly. We cannot take shortcuts because those do not hold up in court.
Right. You know, around the country, we've heard in the last decade or so, maybe more than that, about these police departments that have a closet full of unprocessed SANE kits and these giant backlogs of hundreds or thousands of sexual assault nurse examiner kits. That's what SANE means, SANE kit. Basically, these are rape kits that have not been processed.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have that problem in Vermont?
I am really happy to say that we do not.
The Williamson County Cultural Arts Commission of Franklin, Tennessee wishes to thank our men and women in blue who help us deliver safe and fun family and community cultural events year-round, including one of the only authentic bluegrass festivals in the country. Bluegrass Along the Harvest takes place every July and at the Williamson County Fair in August and at the annual Tennessee International Independent Film Festival. Check out our full calendar of events at wccac-tn.org.
The state of Vermont has, for over a decade, had a really fabulous tracking system. It's not super fancy. It used to be an Excel spreadsheet. I think it's online now. Every kit that is created for the state of Vermont has a barcode on it. And so we know when the manufacturer makes those kits. We know when they get sent to hospitals. We know if one is used for QC purposes. We know if one is used for collection. If it's used for collection, the investigator is required to bring it to the lab within 72 hours. And we know when they don't, because we're tracking those barcodes, and we have been for decades. So occasionally we'll have one where we're like, you know, the investigator hasn't gotten it to us and it's been a month now. But our issues are small potatoes compared to a lot of other states. And the other wonderful thing about the state of Vermont is that we have in the same kit permission forms, whether it's a reported or an anonymous kit, the victim signs a consent form to allow us to upload it. And if they don't want to sign that consent form, they don't have to. But the nurse examiners explain to them how we maintain their privacy through an anonymous kit and are still able to upload to CODIS, which means that we are possibly the only or one of very few states that are uploading all of the anonymous kits to CODIS, which allows us to then look for a potential serial rapist who is managing to get away without being caught because their cases all come forward as anonymous. And we don't have that here either. We don't have a backlog of anonymous kits that aren't being uploaded either. Vermont was ahead of the curve on that. And I have explained to a handful of other states how we do that because there is a lot of documentation, a lot of legal requirement before you can just upload something to the database. And our database and our documents are all really well set up to actually allow us to do that. And there are other states that are trying to learn from our successes there.
So I just want to touch on that, what you just said. It's not like the cops are just rolling around at crime scenes and throwing some cigarette butts and some used cups or pizza crusts or a tissue, a Kleenex or whatever, and just throwing it all at the lab and saying, hey, let's grab some DNA off these, right?
Yeah, some cops are better at investigating than others. I won't say none of the cops are doing that. But when we get those submissions, we go back with the investigator and we'll say, okay, we need to figure out what here is really probative. And we're actually required by the FBI to document eligibility on any case that goes up to CODIS. So we have to get back in touch with the investigators and say, how is this linked to the crime? That's a requirement for anything that goes into CODIS is how is this linked to the crime? We frequently will have a conversation with the investigator about like, okay, you found this cigarette butt outside of the burglary. Was it on a sidewalk in Burlington where any number of people might have dropped a cigarette butt? Or was it around back by the door that was broken into? And we need that level of detail in order to upload something to CODIS.
I want to go back to the, Jen, I'm so glad you brought this up because it was on my mind too, the kit backlog, that question. And I want to drill down more on recommendations for other states and how we can improve how it's working and get other states to a zero backlog like Vermont. So you mentioned the barcode, which seems like it's a really important factor in being able to track all the kits and being able to just know whether it's processed or not. And you're also talking about, Jen, you brought up this idea that maybe some crime scenes or kits are kind of overloaded, like there's too much evidence, or maybe I'm just looking at like, what are the problems that other states are experiencing? And it, does it have something to do also with population? And that in some areas, they just don't have the number of professionals to track or handle the amount of evidence or kits that they're getting in. Like, what are the hurdles and how can you direct a state with a huge backlog to not only diminish that backlog, get it to a zero level like Vermont, but also in the future, just have it work smoothly?
I think you've hit exactly right when you say part of it is population-based. Vermont was very lucky that because we're a small state, we were able to track the sexual assault kit serial numbers in an Excel spreadsheet for a decade. And that's because we have 600,000 or 700,000 people total in the whole state. So we just don't have that many serial numbers that we need to track. And bigger states, bigger cities, their kits probably had serial numbers on them, but back in the 90s, nobody was tracking those because they were so many. I think that is a big thing. Another thing, and one that I have pointed out to a bunch of states, and it's harder for them to implement, is the permission to upload even from a anonymous kit. And that requires a change in the paperwork. So again, a state that's ordering 10,000 or 30,000 kits at a time can say, all right, we'll make that change in our paperwork the next time we order kits. But they've got just a higher throughput. So they have a lot more that they have to go through before they can implement these changes.
Is some of the reason why these kits got shoved in a closet because they perhaps did not have permission to upload from an anonymous victim? So therefore, there's no probative value to having the sample in CODIS?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it is if it's an anonymous kit, the investigator looks at it and goes, well, the victim isn't coming forward. The investigator has a limited amount of time. They can do their job. They're going to focus on the ones where the victim is coming forward and not on the ones that are anonymous. And so those absolutely got stuffed in a closet because they were like, I don't know what else to do with this. I can't investigate it because I can't go interview the victim. And it got ignored. A lot of it was also, unfortunately, investigators not believing victims. And we've done a lot of work and a lot of training over the last 5 years to sort of try and adjust those biases. But there's, I wish I could remember her name. There's a really interesting researcher out in Michigan who helped them identify and eliminate their kit backlog, who's done a lot of interesting work on bias and the reason that victims aren't always believed. Some is victim blaming and some is the just not being able to do anything with an anonymous kit.
Well, and not everybody has access to a world-class lab like we have in Vermont. I will take a moment to brag on our lab that we are. I mean, maybe you can describe the type of accreditation we achieve every 2 years. We have a state-of-the-art facility that is a real gem for a state like ours.
Yep, we are very lucky. We got this new building in 2011, I think. And it allows us to meet the international ISO. But we meet the ISO accreditation standards for an independent forensic lab. They come out and audit us on a regular basis. I mean, it's a lot of work, but it's important to maintain those standards so that the work we're doing can be presented in court and can be as flawless as humanly possible.
And I should point out for our listeners that the Vermont Forensic Laboratory is one of the 7 divisions of the Vermont Department of Public Safety, which I am the commissioner of. And it is led by the fearless Dr. Tricia Conti, who could not be with us today, but she leads a team of very dedicated scientists and others who examine things way beyond just DNA and CODIS to keep our criminal justice system churning and keeping up with best practices. So the lab is definitely a source of tremendous pride for the Department of Public Safety and the state of Vermont.
Sounds very modern and very integral to just keeping things safe and keeping everybody knowledgeable. I love the interconnection between the lab and the rest of the world. That makes a huge difference. It basically, if I were some kind of criminal, I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to go a state over. You know, like it does not seem like a good state to be caught doing something bad in because you're going to be more visible, basically.
I think that's true. And, you know, beyond DNA and the work that Rebecca's doing in her section, we have folks who are experts in tool marks, in footprints, in handprints, fingerprints, ballistics. There's so many other pieces to the forensic puzzle. Rebecca, I'm sure I missed a lot of them, but we have a really tremendous capacity. And as you said, the whole state of Vermont's a medium-sized city in the United States, right?
It's true.
Right. So you are more visible, I think, in a state like ours when you are identified. And it's a little easier to find one out of 750,000 than it is to find one out of a city of 20 million, right? Or 8 million or 3 million. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think if I were contemplating doing terrible things, I think I'd hop one state over, two states or three
At
states
least
over
one.
Two.
Maybe three. So, Rebecca, thank you for taking a look at our friend's case and some of the history around that. I wonder if you could bring any commentary or thoughts that you had about what happened in our friend's case, and I'd just love to hear it through the lens of your expert experience.
Your friend's case is absolutely the sort of case that CODIS is designed to solve because it was basically a random happening. And because the perpetrator was a serial rapist and a serial killer and moved around a lot. And so those are the kinds of people who move on before they get caught and then do all of their evilness again in another location and another location. And the ability to take those DNA profiles, upload them, compare them across states, link them up, put the investigators in touch with each other. That is how we solve these crimes because there's not another good way to track these people.
It's true. It's what brought all the pieces together for Rachel and Warren.
Yep.
It is very shocking, like that moment when his DNA is in the system and you can look around and see all the things that he did, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And obviously there was some good work on the West Coast where they were able to like take him into custody. And strangely enough, like the gangs that he was hanging out with had played a huge role in him getting arrested very quickly on from the really big event that happened because they didn't want to have anything to do with him and they didn't want his actions to implicate them and their interactions with other gangs.
Yeah, yeah.
I always find that to be a really interesting piece of the story. And I don't know if this is the perfectly appropriate place to say this, but we have an appeal within baked within our show that you've heard, which is that if someone knew this guy or was involved, you know, either on a personal level or through a crime, we want to talk to you. And I think it would be extremely informative to hear from some of those now much older former gang folks who knew him and came into contact with him.
Yeah, that would be fascinating to hear from someone who knew him on a personal level, because yeah, it's always interesting. But in some cases, people be like, oh yeah, that guy always seemed a little weird. And then in with other perpetrators, the neighbors or the aunts and uncles are just blown away. They never had any inkling. It would be really interesting to hear from someone who knew him.
Are you a true crime aficionado? You say that like someone who's...
I am selective. Some podcasts, some TV shows are really interesting. I also don't, I'm not an aficionado who listens to like all of it. And I feel very much like in my core, I do this 40 hours a week at my work and I come home and I want to watch some comedy. Like I really-
Or the Hallmark Channel.
Yeah, Hallmark Channel. Yep, yep. funny podcast. Yeah, anything, some sci-fi. I can handle, you know, like, I can handle gore and guts, no problem, but I want it to be related to dragons. I tried to watch The Sopranos. I could not handle The Sopranos. I was like, this is too close to what I do every single day. I can't watch this TV show.
But did you hear that, Hollywood? More comedy, more comedy.
Yes, please.
More dragons.
More dragons.
Tell me more about like how you derive the satisfaction and pride for the work you're doing.
You really do have to focus on the things that get solved, because they're is so much that we don't get solved. And, you know, there will be cases where we don't get DNA off of whatever the evidence is. And so then we have no further leads to give the investigator. And as the person who processes all the convicted offender samples, I say my day-to-day work is a lot of tubes. We process 96 well plates. So I have like 90 samples at a time. They've got long numbers. There's very small amounts of liquid. I move them from one machine to another. It's not super related to the crimes at all. And so then I have to sort of focus in on the CODIS matches, the reports I send out, the things we're actually doing and actually solving. And, you know, we can't get them all, but the ones that we do keep me going.
That's right. Knowing that you give the family and loved ones some sense of closure.
Exactly.
I doubt your world ends in too many happy endings, nor did mine. But
unfortunately, yeah.
But there really is something to be said about being able to provide information, to be able to give a spark of hope in an investigation, even if it doesn't ultimately lead to an arrest, but being able to, you know, advance the ball down the field in terms of the investigation.
Yep, exactly right.
One of the things that I know, I was thinking about the timeline of your career. In the course of your career, DNA and genealogy websites have become very, very popular. 23andMe, Ancestry.com, you name it. There's a bunch of commercial places out there that will collect your spit. You send it off. They send you back this actually unbelievable amount of information about the likelihood that you will have allergies, asthma, high blood pressure, eczema, and plus they pull out your family matches. There's just an incredible amount of things that happen. How can the public know that what's being collected there isn't crossing streams with what you're running?
That's a very good question. So the profiles that we're running are actually short tandem repeats, which are a completely different region of DNA from what those companies are running. They're running SNPs, which are single nucleotide polymorphisms. So they're looking at different regions of DNA, which is why they can look for illnesses or your fourth cousin three times removed, whereas what we're looking at is just identity and no genetic screenings. Some familial relationship work can be done with STRs, but the lab is only accredited for parent-child comparisons. So we use that if we're looking for like a missing person, but we can't even do sibling-to-sibling comparisons because the math is completely different. So yeah, on just like a base level, the answer is that CODIS is a standalone system run by the FBI, which is completely separate and uses different technology from the technology that these private companies are using. That being said, some of the private companies do cooperate with investigators, and that's where the forensic genetic genealogy searches come in. The most famous one being the Golden State Killer. And in those cases, investigators are looking at a cold case that hasn't been solved for a long time, where they have DNA of the perpetrator, and CODIS hasn't been able to come up with any matches. And they send the DNA to usually a forensic agency that is also running those SNP profiles, and they generate those profiles, and then we'll go to the public companies and be like, can you run this through your system? We're looking for those third cousins. We need some kind of information. And when the Golden State Killer came out, that one shook a lot of people's foundations, because the companies had sort of like buried in the fine print when you send your saliva in that they might use your DNA, but they hadn't been super forthcoming about it. And since then, most of the companies have come forward, and you can actually, if you're paying attention, if you're reading, it doesn't, not even the fine print, it's usually further up now in the agreement you're signing, whether you want to opt in to investigative searching or opt out. But yeah, so that's absolutely it's a thing people ask me about a lot. Even just like friends and relatives will be like, well, what do you think about running these profiles? I think it's fine. I think it's super interesting. And most of them at this point will give you the option to opt in or opt out of investigative work. I like to say to people, most people don't know their third cousins anyway. So you think about like a first cousin or an aunt or an uncle. If they were a serial killer, would you want to help them hide? Or would you want to have them come to justice? And if you are the sort of person who's like, yeah, if my uncle's a serial killer, he should be brought to justice, then opt in, because that's all we're doing here.
No, that's interesting. So not all DNA is DNA is DNA, right? You're talking about a SNP versus the other thing. And so there's a sample.
Yeah.
And depending on what your purpose is with that sample, you would handle it in the lab very differently to extract different packets.
So all DNA is DNA. The DNA in any cell in your body is all basically the same. But then, yeah, we get into the lab, we break open the cell, we extract the DNA so that, like, getting rid of all the proteins and sugars and everything else that's in a cell. So we've just the DNA. And then what we do is we say, okay, we're gonna amplify it. We're gonna make copies of copies of copies, so there's enough for our instrument to read. And are we going to amplify the short tandem repeats, which give us just identity? Or are we going to amplify the single nucleotide polymorphisms that let us look at illnesses? In the medical field, they can look for trisomies, they can look for celiac disease, all of those different things. And in that case, basically what we're doing is we're looking to make copies of those certain regions of DNA. And we tell the enzymes which regions we're looking for by using primers that match to the specific part of DNA we want.
Awesome.
Fascinating.
So here's something I'd like to do around DNA with our case.
Mm-hmm.
We know that this guy was a serial rapist and that he actually didn't kill all of his rape victims. So mm-hmm. hypothesis is that he has kids out there
mm-hmm.
that we don't know about.
Yeah.
And that some of those kids may actually be searching for the identity of their father.
Yep.
And so I'm just assuming that all we would necessarily need to do is make sure that some DNA from a sibling was in the system, and then those kids would match with the sibling.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
I mean, it's, again, when kinship analysis, having the parent-child connection is the strongest, the easiest one to document. But they, especially when you're looking with SNPs instead of STRs, you can absolutely do those sibling and even cousin matches. And so, yes, if you had one child that you knew was from the perpetrator and they ran their profile in SNPs and it went into the database, it would absolutely match with siblings as well as cousins.
I don't know if I'd want to know if my dad was a serial murderer or serial rapist.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I'd be okay without knowing that.
It's an interesting question. And it's one, in terms of kinship, it's coming up more and more often with sperm donors than with serial rapists. But it's a similar question where you're like, do you want to know that that's who your other parent is?
I think that's the fear when you go looking for your heritage, you know, in any way, like a parent, like if you were adopted, there's a concern that what am I going to come up with? And
mm-hmm.
some people hit the lottery and some people don't. What I'm discovering is the not knowing is more painful than the knowing.
Mm.
So even if you find out something that's unpleasant, you've kind of filled this gap. It's kind of like getting a diagnosis so you can now know what you're dealing with, you know?
Yeah, there's definitely some truth to that in that at least now you know and you're not left wondering all the time. I do have some friends who have been adopted who work in adoption circles. I know that that is unfortunately not always the case. I have heard stories of people who found out basically that they were put up for adoptions for really good reasons and that their birth family is not anything that they wanted to be associated with, unfortunately. But you can't know. So it's a big question.
Yeah, I now want to publicly apologize to the person who I know who was adopted, who was like, I don't care where I came from. I love how I was raised and I love my family. And I was like, but don't you want to know? And he's like, nope, no thanks.
You know? Hey, I think that's a tremendous attitude of gratitude. And some people are more curious than others. You know, Rebecca, I think of the work that you and all of your teammates at the lab do, and it is hiding in plain sight heroes right there. These are not the people who are ever going to be on the front page of the paper at a press conference announcing the arrest of this heinous perpetrator. These are the heroes hiding in plain sight at the lab, and we could not do the work that we do to keep Vermonters safe without you guys. So thank you.
And thank you very much. I will say many of us are happier hiding in plain sight. We became scientists because we don't necessarily want to be at the front desk during the press conference.
That's true.
Maybe this could be around our final question. What are you excited about in terms of the future of the work that you're doing? What are some of the things that you want to tell us about that are happening on the floor? Do you keep up with that?
Yeah, we absolutely keep up. One of the requirements for being ISO accredited is that we have continuing education and that we keep up with the technology. And I will say that forensics version of keeping up is not necessarily the same as research because everything we do has to go through a court. So it has to be well documented. But what's coming and what some labs are already using, and this is going to be very nerdy of me, but we're looking at probabilistic software to help us deconvolute mixtures. And so what that means is if you've got a mixture of just two people and you have like one person, there's more DNA and the other person, there's less DNA. And you can look at that and be like, this is my major donor and my minor donor. And I can figure out what the profiles are pretty well. But you start putting in three or four people in that mixture, or the amounts of DNA are pretty level. So you can't tell which peaks, which alleles came from which person. And it can get really complicated and be uninterpretable. And then we have no way to provide an investigative lead for solving that crime. And we're looking into software, and some labs are already using software that will look at those complex mixtures and apply some really fancy statistical calculations, which will then help to figure out who the contributors are on those mixtures so that we can then provide more information. It's coming and it's very exciting. It's also a lot of math.
A lot of math for you or baked into the software?
Yes. It's baked into the software, but one of the things we're doing right now is going through the process of validating, so confirming that the software works the way it's supposed to in our system. And it takes a lot of statistics and a lot of understanding just to document that, even though then the software is what's doing all the math on the day-to-day. But it uses the probabilistics that I'm talking about are like, that's what the weather people use to like predict long-term forecasts. And it's used in all kinds of astronomy and it's some really fancy math, basically, but that's what's coming next.
What about legislatively, either in your state or in other states? What's inspiring to you?
Another thing that's getting rolled out right now is a lot of states, we talked about collecting DNA at arrest or arraignment. And in states where collecting DNA at arrest is happening, we're also starting to do real-time DNA comparison. So the CODIS software has been improved recently so that we can upload a DNA profile from the more violent, so like a kidnapping or a sexual assault, and we can flag it for real-time searching. And then if the individual is arrested in another state, they run their DNA profile before they release them. And if it matches to one of these kidnapping, sexual assault, murder crimes, they'll hold the guy. So even if he's arrested at 2 a.m. in Florida, if it matches to a Vermont crime, they call the investigator in the middle of the night and they're like, hey, we have a DNA match on this case. And the investigator in Vermont can be like, okay, great, hold him. When my state's attorney gets in the morning, we'll start the extradition. And so then those guys aren't back out on the street after arrest and before arraignment. They're in custody and they stay in custody so they can't do any more crime.
And that's happening in many states or?
So I just came back from a conference and it's happening in one state so far. Louisiana has implemented this DNA collection and comparison at arrest, but there's a bunch of states working on it. It's brand new to the software.
That sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, it's one of those things like we won't be doing it in Vermont because we can't collect DNA at a rest based on our state constitution. But it's something that the states that can do it are looking into it. And it'll be great for keeping people off the streets so they're not committing more crime before they get convicted.
Sounds very exciting. And I love to think about where the future of this type of science will go. Mm-hmm. I also love that Vermont takes a really serious look and balancing act at civil liberties versus deterrence.
Absolutely.
And I think that is an important piece of this, that we can't trample people's civil liberties just because the science allows us to do something with their sample that was produced for X reason. So I think there has to be a constant balancing of individual privacy versus leveraging science to prevent serious crime and harm to other Absolutely. Community members. I'm not
freedom,
sure the Vermont
freedom
legislature
and unity.
Always has it. Freedom and unity. Vermont legislature might not always have it right.
But what is the Vermont state motto? Freedom and unity.
That's right. It is. Freedom and unity.
In conclusion, is there anything that we missed that you would like to contribute to the conversation?
No, I think this was very thorough. So I guess one thing I would, and I don't know how long we have, one thing I would add is in that expectations of privacy and maintaining people's civil liberties. There was recently an instance out in California of a victim standard from a sexual assault being matched to a burglary. And that is exactly the sort of thing that we in Vermont are trying very hard not to have happen. And it was in the news quite a bit for understandable reasons. And it was, in the end, it wasn't a CODIS lab that had sent that report. It was a database of victim profiles outside of CODIS. And so a lot of states are looking at those kinds of databases outside of CODIS and how are they maintained and what laws are they following and should they be there? And also, how are we releasing this information and why? Because we don't want to discourage victims from providing their standards. We don't want to discourage them from coming forward out of a fear that they might be connected to something else down the road.
So the victim could have gotten jammed for participating in a burglary because the sample from a rape kit,
exactly,
which had the offender of the rape's DNA commingled.
Yep. Yeah. And so that's unfortunate, right? Like people who are in unfortunate life circumstances where they might end up being part of a burglary or part, you know, like people who are involved in prostitution, there are plenty of people who are victims, but also sometimes on the other side of the law, on perpetrators, and they deserve to have their crimes solved too. So it's important that they feel comfortable coming forward when they are the victim of a crime and providing that DNA standard without fear that it's going to be used against them down the road. And so I guess that's like the one piece we haven't really covered here is that state labs, the FBI, especially here in Vermont, but across the country, people working in the CODIS system are working really hard to balance that, to respect the victim's needs for privacy and not just use the DNA because we have it, but look at the legality and the morality of it.
Wow.
I know. It's so much more complex than what they show on CSI.
Yes.
Well, Rebecca, I'm so appreciative of you taking your time on a weekend to talk with us for our podcast. And I'm so appreciative of the work that you and the entire team do at the lab every single day.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you or someone you know is connected either personally or as the result of violent crime to Alfredo Prieto, a convicted rapist and killer who lived in and around San Bernardino, California, Arlington, Virginia, and Jamaica, Queens, New York between the years of 1984 and 1990, we'd like to hear from you. Please email us at info@theheromakerpodcast.com.
Thanks to sound mixer and podcast producer Michael Doherty, sound designer Andy Bill of Submachine Audio, and graphic designer Jungleen Bay. Thanks also to me, Hero Maker director and producer Andrea Schreeland. Please subscribe to the show where you listen to podcasts and take a moment to rate us. It really helps the podcast grow. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The Hero Maker Pod. Want to collaborate or suggest a guest? Please email us at media@theheromakerpodcast.com. The Hero Maker Podcast is a production of Prudent Pictures. Thank you so much for listening.